So I would like to give sort of a description of our new view of entanglements and tubes, and that comes from the rub elasticity direction. And this work is actually based on a paper that was published by Sergei Penyukov about 17 years ago in 1985, where he used a very complicated replica theory to describe rub elasticity with full-blown topology in it. In a only approximation was that it's a mean field theory, meaning that you have topology is due to effect of many chain on a given one. And so the results were very intriguing, and I didn't understand them very well. I could follow some of the mathematics, but I can follow the replicas, but when you take the limit of number of replicas going to zero, my intuition begins to fail. And though I can follow the math, I have a hard time visualizing this. And so for about 10 years ago, I decided to start working with Sergei to convert that same calculation into something I can actually understand. So it's sort of, the analog would be the Dyson versus Feynman diagrams. The math is the same, but we are trying to develop a physical intuition to what this deforming tubes mean, what is the physics happening, what the origin of topological confinement, and what happens to it when you deform the networks. So I will start introducing it from the sort of historical beginning. What are the basic fundamental ideas that go into the development of the theory? And please, despite what Scott tells you, interrupt me, ask questions. If I don't have an agenda, if I finish only half of the talk, but you understand that, it'll be great.
Today's talk was given by Zersky. I think Scott's comment has something to do with that.
Okay.
I think we might explore it.
Well, all of the answers were given by somebody else anyway, so it doesn't matter. Okay, so... Okay, so I will describe this again. This is the work based, most of the theory up to the slip tube idea were basically developed by Sergei in 1985. And he published it in 1985, and we just derived it with a new formalism. And then the new model that I'll describe at the end is the slip tube model, which is an extension of that idea. So we'll start with the...
Rule number two has something to do with the question Ralph posed last week.
Yes.
Just to recall people.
Yes. It's everything that I'm going to tell you today is strongly related to what Ralph was telling you in the previous two talks he gave. So the basic question we are trying to answer is, what is the microscopic description of network elasticity? So the general folklore is that the origin of network elasticity is entropic. There are some questions one can ask about that, but we will take this as an axiom and will ignore all the energetic contributions to elasticity, even though they can be taken into account, but that's not what we're after. So we're only looking for what happens with the entropy of chains when you form a network, only when you deform the network. And so the idea or the questions we're going to be asking is the following. If you have a piece of rubber on some very high magnification, it's made out of connected chains, when you deform your piece of rubber, those chains somehow are deformed, the entropy is changed, typically reduced when you deform it. And you want to understand how this reduction of entropy gives you the stress that you measure from deforming the macroscopic network. More detailed questions is, how do this macroscopic deformation transmitted down to the strands? At some large scales, everything is fine. Everything moves proportional to deformation up to some scale. Scale smaller than that, you have to talk about chains being pulled what is the Slank scale that cross, you have a crossover from continuum elasticity to microscopic chain deformation? Is this in how to calculate that length scale and how it changes with deformation, or is it constant? And so we're going to look at, for example, end-to-end distance of a strand, and if it's some value in undeformed, so lambda is the extension factor. When you deform your network, this end-to-end distance changes. And the simplest possible model, simplest possible assumption is the following, that you take your strand, you nail the ends with the hammer to some elastic background, and then the whole strand is going to be forced to deform. Well, the end-to-end vector of the strand has to be deformed affinely because it's nailed. There is no possibility for it. And therefore, we will be able to describe this deformation of a strand as a single chain problem. And that, in fact, is the one of the classic models of rubber elasticity that was developed 60 years ago by Wolf, Laurie, Renner, etc., where they cross links are replaced, are displaced affinely as if they are just nailed to some ether elastic background that is perfectly elastic. And so they're not allowed to fluctuate. They are fixed in space. And if the ends are fixed in space, then the free energy of the chain is very easy to calculate. It's number density of chains, concentration of monomers divided by number of monomers per chain, Kt over 2, and the expansion factors in two directions. Now, to make sure Tom is awake, why is it a half, not 3/2?
I'm not awake.
Okay. You're 1 year old. You have to be wiser. Okay. Huh? Pardon me? Right, but if we are deforming only in X and Y and Z are fixed as you have in a perfect tube, and you're stretching only in one direction along the tube, say in Z, why would the prefactor be here 1/2, not 3/2? I just want to make sure you're with me. I mean, if you lose me here, we'll be. The rest of the talk is really not important. I understand. I'm trying to wake you up, guys. I know, but I'm saying if lambdas are constant and I'm only changing one of them, the dependence of free energy on the deformation has 1/2 here, not 3/2. So the question.
Two are one, not zero.
Pardon me?
The other two lambdas are one. Not
right,
zero.
Right. So, like if you're talking about classical tube model, which is a hard wall, the other two directions are constant, and you're only looking at the stretching and fluctuation in one direction, is the potential 3/2 or 1/2?
We have two prefactors. One prefactor is the spring constant of the individual springs, and the
yes.
other one is the extension of these objects in the ground state.
Right, okay. Okay, I'll leave it as the homework.
True one dimensional answer is 1/2.
Pardon me?
True one dimensional answer is 1/2.
Well, this is basically a three dimensional case where the other two dimensions are not deformed, as you have in a constant tube model.
If each of the lambdas is 1, that is a factor of
3. Right, but there is no, but it's not a potential anymore. It's a.
In the tube, you have lambda 1, lambda 0 fixed, and then the lambda x can sample three dimensions, and you get a factor of 3 from that sample.
Right, I'm talking about one-dimensional infinitely straight tube. Lambda x and lambda y are 1, and lambda z is your stretching along the tube. And in this case, as a function of lambda z...
Can you get your happy incompressibility?
Yes, the compressibility is not an answer here. Okay, I'll ask. Let me. Yes.
That's what I'm saying.
Yes.
The spring constant, this k, is 3 kT over r squared.
Yeah, you're getting very close to it. Yes, exactly. It's yes.
R squared
yes.
over 3.
Yes, it's a question. Yeah, it's a question of what how. Yeah. Okay. Somebody's away. Great. So now we talk about incompressible networks, and you have uniaxial deformation. So you have changing one direction, say expanding or compressing, and the other two basically slave and have to change to conserve the volume. Then you get a classical expression for the free energy, and by taking logarithmic derivative, you get a derivative depending whether you're talking about stress per unstrained area or real stress or engineering stress. This is engineering stress, which is a lambda comes from this the extension direction, and 1 over lambda square comes from the other two directions. And the modulus over the affine network is kT times the number density of strands, and that's what actually used for the definition of entanglement molecular weight for all the entanglement theories, typically, if you want to ignore 5/6 or 7/5 or anything else you like, which is just classical affine model where the ends are nailed. There is no 3 in this formula. And so this is the, again, one of the classical reviews by Triolar, one of the people who worked extensively in this area. The y-axis is the tensile force per unit unstrained area, which is what I was gave as the last equation. The x-axis is lambda, which is relative extension. Points are experiments, and the line is the fit to this affine model with the fit attempting to get the right slope at the beginning. So you're trying to get the behavior in a linear or near linear regime, and you can see that you have something called strain softening, where the experiments very soon after you get any reasonable deformation becomes stress is less than theory predicts, then they cross and stress becomes more than theory predicts. And this part has been more or less understood due to fine accessibility of chains, and so it's been fitted by different models like inverse Langevin or something else. This part, to date, is a mystery. And so I will focus about our attempt to understand this part, where the chains are still can be thought to be practically Gaussian, because you're not really deforming any significant fraction of maximum extension, but the classical theories fail and you have strain softening.
Perhaps show similar plots from similar reference, and
yes,
he showed very perfect agreement of experiment.
I think Michael's version is better. I'm going to get that one.
I'm sorry, that is the, I mean, people in 40s have spent a lot of time doing very careful experiments and try to do the best to explain the theory. And there is, actually I will show much better fits where you actually divide this by that to get the actual difference, and that's what we'll be talking about. It's called Mooney plot. I'm just showing first versus distance so you can get some feeling what we're talking about before you divide. But in a Mooney plot, what you should be following for is a decrease away from, as you begin to extend, the ratio is decreasing with extension.
You might have the finite extensibility because you cannot understand it from the problem picture.
Well, yes, you have to, yeah, the finite extensibility, you need to have a finite length of the chain.
Yeah.
But that was built in right away in very early in 40s. People have added that into the classical model.
The end-to-end length of a real rubber, then this comes out much too large extensions. Where you need entanglements to reduce that to where you find the
extension. Right. That's a good point as well. You need to
location
the location of a divergence to understand that you have to know.
If you take the full end-to-end of a
yes, that's
then
a good point. Yes.
You can extend it for much longer than you.
Very good point. So it quantitatively, qualitatively the upturn was understood. Quantitatively it was not. Yes. Well, but that is the enthalpy contribution that I to ignore. Yes, I agree with you. Okay, so the next model, which is physically somewhat more realistic, came actually about the same time was developed by James and Guth, and it's a phantom network model. And in this model, the ends of the chain are not nailed to the elastic background, but are actually chemically attached to other chains. And so the rest of the chain doesn't know it's a part of a network. There is no interaction between any other monomer of the chain and the network. The only reason it knows it's a part of a network is because its ends are chemically attached to other chains. That is the phantom network model. And so the information comes through the ends, and so all of the story and all of the action is at the ends in the phantom network model. And how well it knows it's a part of a network depends how localized the ends are, how much are they fixed with respect to a fine background versus how much they fluctuate. And so the fluctuation of, for example, end-to-end vector between x1 and x2 would depend on two factors: how elastic the chain itself is and how soft or stiff the local or network that these points are attached to. Is this clear part? So now I will split those pieces in two parts. I'll first talk about how soft or hard the network is. So what we are going to do is...
It's still a mean field background. There's some point in space that has a zero for the energy for the end. In the elastic background.
Zero energy for the end.
You have it's to fluctuate around some point.
Very good point. So what is the average location for the end? And is this, so this is going to be actually the next point. So let's discuss it now. So let's first break away the chain, cut the chain off, and just look at the crosslink without the chain, and ask, what does the crosslink do if the chain were not there before you connected it? And what the crosslink does, it's going to fluctuate in space around some average point. Is this average point going to be the average location for our end of our chain? Good. So the point of attachment, this average point, the fluctuation of this crosslink without our chain, is not the place where the chain end on average will be. And so now this end is going to fluctuate around, and it basically can be represented as a point, an end over some kind of a chain, virtual chain, that is nailed, the one end of virtual chain is nailed to the average point, and the other end fluctuates. So the mean square fluctuations of the end of a chain with some number of monomers N1 can be some number psi1, and can be a number N1 can be adjusted, so the mean square fluctuation of an end junction of a point without the chain would be the same as of this thing. If this is a Gaussian network, sum of Gaussian is Gaussian, you add parabolas and you get basically this spring represents a potential that the end of your chain feels, and it represents the connection between the end of the chain and the elastic background. Okay, so this is a very important point. This is trivial change of notation from the classic solution, but it's important to understand the rest of the story. So now we have our chain with n monomers that is connected at the junction point to these two virtual chains that represent softness of the local environment, and these virtual chains are nailed to those points x1 and x2 in a fine, non-fluctuating background. So the affine chain is now a combined chain of three sections, a real chain and two effective chains that tell you how much the ends allow to fluctuate. So now when I stretch my network, I deform these attachment points that are nailed to the background. That distance deforms the Finley. The rest of this thing stretches as a single chain. We know how single chain stretches. All we need to know is how many monomers are here and how many monomers are there.
Can I ask
Can you repeat again why nailed point deforma finally?
The nail points deforma finally because they are effectively right here. This point tells you how far this junction point fluctuates in, this is a part of a network. In a mean field theory, the average position of fluctuation deforms affinely, and the amplitude of fluctuation doesn't change. So these are two very important issues. The Gaussian networks, their fluctuation don't depend on how much they're stretched. Finite accessibility changes that here, they don't change. So in my combined chain.
Yeah, the fluctuation don't change, I understand. But why is average positions deform finally?
The average position of a junction point fluctuation deforms the finally, yes. It's not an assumption. This is easily derived in a phantom network model.
For Gaussian chains.
For Gaussian, yeah, we're talking about Gaussian chains.
Gaussian
yeah.
Phantom chains.
Gaussian.
Follow your assumptions. You're assuming that the network remains Gaussian, also in the presence of entanglements.
No, there is no entanglements yet.
Okay.
I'm assuming the statistics of the chain is Gaussian, whether they're entangled or not.
That's an assumption.
I think that can be easily derived until you start deforming. I'm not talking about potential, but the we are saying that the chains, the statics of the chain is not affected by the entanglement.
The statics.
And the Gaussian issue is entropy only, which is statics.
Okay.
You agree with that?
Yeah.
So if all I'm doing is I'm looking over all of the possible trajectories of my chains within a given constraints, which is a some of all possible Gaussian trajectories, because this is statics.
Okay.
So assumption, it's not real assumption, it's derived from the thermodynamics of a melt or network, okay?
Would the deformation necessarily be off from if you have inhomogeneities? I mean, if you have inhomogeneities...
Right, so you can actually calculate, you can calculate the effect to what extent mean field theory is correct, and for large n, chains are strongly overlapping, and there is basically one overlap parameter is the large number. I mean, for entanglement mesh, it's already 20. We're talking about chains that are much bigger than that. Those inhomogeneities have to do with these back loops that actually can be expanded out from the theory. You can do corrections to that. But it turns out that there, if you're talking about some global properties like elasticity, not important. If you talk about single chain properties, they are important. Of scattering, they are important.
But argument doesn't go with phantom network. Yeah? For phantom network
is
homogeneity is very important in phantom network.
No, I'm sorry.
Why?
Because it's linear springs.
The average position of any point deforms any junction point in a phantom network deforms.
For regular network or for random.
Random networks.
For random, when you can have a lot of branches here and a few branches there, and this more dense area will deform non-affinely compared to the.
You're talking about corrections to the mean field theory.
Yeah, but why are they not important in randomly branched network?
Yeah, that's inhomogeneity.
Yes. Yeah.
When you say mean field theory, you mean there is an approximation.
I'm saying that this is the mean field theory, but we're assuming that there are many, many chains overlapping, and those effects that you're talking about average out.
Right.
What is overlapping in phantom network?
You mean high functionality branch points? Because the effect of the difference is like they're overlapping.
Yeah, in phantom network, there's no...
What difference it makes is that if you go from a given point to another point, the probability of connecting back to your same chain...
In other words, high functionality network.
No.
Or high dimensions.
No, not necessarily.
And I don't...
It's
just whatever it is.
It's not some big thing.
Michael, is it that when you have a chain, you connect it to another chain, that the connection is random? That is, that
yes.
You're saying that on average, obviously, a cross-link deforms that finely, and that there's no correlation between the statistics of the chain and the statistics of the cross-link
exactly.
To which it's attached.
Exactly. I'm talking about the fact that there is no correlation between fluctuations here and fluctuation there, and I'm saying that the probability of loops is once you connect to one chain, you go out, the probability of second chain coming back and being the second part of you, basically those loops that kill you are decrease.
Why loops would kill you? I'm not speaking about loops. I'm speaking
about fractionality. Yes, yes. The, if you have fluctuation of the density of junction point, the fluctuations you will have fluctuations in the spring constant as well.
In the affinity.
Not in the affinity.
Your physical intuition is perfectly correct, and that matters when you have systems which are not dense anymore, which are smaller. And then all these things happen, and that's something that they get when you go also treated. But here we are talking about rubber systems which remain dense locally. And then it is more reasonable to assume that we don't have to worry about these.
For phantom network, fluctuations can be estimated, and you can estimate how large the fluctuations are, and you can, and there's an extension parameter, which will tell you how mean theory violated and how large fluctuation corrections are, and basically it's a little something like it's the analog of Ginzburg criterion.
Yeah.
And you can actually do expansion on that, but I think for most cases this is not the problem. There is a problem if you're specifically asking about what single chain does, not average over many chains. For single chain, absolutely true. Now, if you're going to be average over many chains, then on average things deform affinely. Not really for each specific chain. Maybe that is the problem. In fact, what you will see here is that the size of these chains, as was calculated by Flory, the size of these virtual chains depends on functionality. And so the Flory showed that they are actually the larger the functionality, the smaller is this, the shorter are these chains, the more you nailed to the less of fluctuation of the junction points. And to make sure that you're still following me, is the end-to-end distance of your chain, is it deform affinely in this quantum model?
Yes, it's a reduced frequency.
Okay.
Oh, no,
yes and no. It's a question whether you're talking about the average end-to-end vector or if you're talking about root mean square end-to-end vector. The average end-to-end vector, yes, it you're right, it deforms affinely with the reduced prefactor, which is basically the ratio of total number of monomers n1 plus n2 plus n divided by n1 plus n2 of n. This is reduced prefactor because the average position of any point here would be on this line with a particular projection that depends how far away you are from the end on average. Now, if you add fluctuations to that, then you will not, the deformation will be non-affine. So mean square and turn distance does deform affinely. Okay, and so to summarize this model, you recover again since the main point that I somehow overlooked so far is that the number of monomers in this fluctuating chains in your potential in an affine model, sorry, in a phantom model, doesn't change with deformation because it's due to the sum of all the Gaussian chains that are holding you in the network. And so this N1 and N2 doesn't change. And all they do is renormalize the total length of your affine strain. Now your affine strain consists of three pieces, not one. But the stress is only kept by this strand, and just add those stresses. So the stress is only supported by your real chain. And therefore, it is reduced by the factor that tells you what fraction of the whole length is your real chain.
It's exact result or estimate?
It's exact result.
You know that it's simple estimate that N1 is equal. You can show that it's exact.
Yes, it is exact result. It's exact result in the mean field theory. And it's derived first by Flory, then I think Higgs and Ball rederived it with a Kelly tree, whatever. There are many ways of rederiving it, but it's if you're assuming otherwise, you have to correct for loops. And there is actually a modification of this result, which is number of links minus number of loops, that tells you what it should be in general. So there are generalization of this result, exact result, to the case with loops. This is a result without loops.
Can you give us an idea as to why this is proportional to the molecular weight of the test chain? You might have just thought, well, actually, this is just some property, local property of the...
Well, yes, it is local property of a network, but you're assuming the network is made of similar chains. And so what you're actually doing is you're assuming, you're saying that your chain is connected to other chains. So you have this junction point that's connected to certain number of chains, and then it's connected to more chains, and it's connected to more chains. You're solving this resistor network.
Right.
You're summing geometric series. You're getting the same. There is only one parameter, which is elasticity of one chain, times the sum of the theory, which gives us this functionality.
So it's technically monodisperse.
Well, if it is monodisperse, it's the exact result. If it's pole dispersed, you get an average, some average n. Which would be, I don't ask me whether it's a weight average or number average at this point, I don't remember. But it will be some average n rather than for pole dispersed system, yes. It can be easily calculated for pole dispersed system with probabilities. People have, in doing rubber theory, have done it for a zillion different cases.
But other remarks you made a few minutes ago, when you said the average is affine, does it matter for the stress whether you're going to pre-average polydispersity in N of the network around these crosslinks, or post-average in the order quenched?
I think you average afterwards. You don't average beforehand. So basically, you are looking at the end-to-end vector. Oh, you're asking whether...
Yes, it's
quite a difficult question. If you introduce disorder in any way, polydispersity is one kind of disorder.
If you introduce some local distortion due to randomness,
yes.
You're asking the correction to be in field theory. I'm not ready to answer it.
Right.
I don't think it is. Well, I mean, it's going to be small in the same parameter, but I don't know exactly how which way it's going to go. I haven't looked at that.
So it's possible only for very small polydispersion as an expansion. I don't think it's possible to express it for arbitrary.
Well, you're talking about different things, I'm sorry. You're talking about effect of polydispersity of this on these pieces,
yes.
Which is...
that seems to be a fairly...
This is very easy to average over, because you're basically averaging over different chains. Each chain does... It's a single chain theory. You go back to a fine model. The affine model is a single chain theory. You're summing over all different chains. Each individual chain does whatever it wants to do. And so you're getting stress from each chain independently, and then you're summing it all together. And this is a trivial correction. Now, the correction with respect to fluctuation, whether these junction points are distorted slightly non-affinely, is slightly fancier, and I'm not sure to answer this, but I expect it's going to be a very small effect. And I think, I hope somebody would actually do a careful simulation of phantom models to answer all these questions. It hasn't been done yet.
Would you struggle for a pre-factor with
You're talking about this thing here. Well, yes.
And the question is, does it ever the stress go through the non-phantom result before it goes there? And what's happening with the energy loss over the time of going from the one state to the other? That's the
one state to the other. What do you mean by one state to the other?
And the one where this factor is one.
Okay, that's what we are talking about next. Good. It's a very good.
Before you run there, can I ask you?
Yes.
You have three springs now in the system.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got three contributions to the free energy.
Yes.
But you're saying now that only one of those contributions contributes to the stress.
Well, I'm saying that contribution contributes to stress for this strand, and you have to sum over all.
Presume that the other ones.
Well, it's not presume; it's done explicitly. I'm sorry, but that's each of those chains that were there are summed over anyway. You're just looking at the effect of surroundings on that particular chain. You sum over. You know how many chains you have in a system. Your free energy sum over that many terms. Each term, you calculate the free energy of that particular chain, and this ends, the free ends for that chain don't contribute to stress. That contribute to free to entropy only.
Physically, I understand that. It's
mathematically done straightforward. I mean, that's what James and Goose did. I mean, that those days they knew what they were doing.
Okay.
Sorry. So the reason I'm talking about that is because of this point here again. So now we're coming 30 years later, mid-70s, the constrained junction model, and that's basically to answer your question. So the people already realized there was something wrong with the classical theory. No matter what you do, you just change prefactor. And all they were talking about at that days is we are doing something wrong with localizing the junctions. So let's try to cross over between nailing the junctions to the background and being them completely free. So we're adding now we know chains in track not only at the ends but throughout the whole chain. There is some kind of additional confinement. How can we model it? Since all chains know about end-to-end distance is the positions of the ends, let's somehow confine those ends to fluctuate less. So let's add additional potential, which is not due to other chains chemically connected to it, but due to some kind of topology. And so this is, thick lines here are our phantom network. The very thin lines here represent nailing, connecting, coupling the junction points to this elastic, non-fluctuating background by some additional potential. So we are saying phantom model is too soft. It ignores other interactions. A fine model seems to be, in their view, too strong. It nails the ends. Junctions don't fluctuate completely freely, but they don't, are not nailed. They do something in between. So let's introduce some potential, additional potential, that tells how less they interact. And so now our effective simple graph corresponding to our test trend is our test trend with n monomers. And then we have this small n is again due to some of all those phantom chains and their restrictions in principle. And there is additional virtual chains that you add that represents additional localizing potential.
Well, I think it's a good point to come back to Jay's question now, because the subtle thing is that you're going to count the free energy which is in these new additional springs. I'm going to say that is an important bit. And the old ones which you introduced, we're going to say, well, that represents other chains in the network, so we don't count that.
I don't count free for each. I know how many real chains are in the system. For each of those real chains, I do this drawing. For each of those real chains, I calculate the free energy. And for each of those real chains, I have to make sure that stress comes only from the thick part. There is no contribution from either this part or this part to stress.
Well, I said free energy.
So free energy, they contribute,
yes.
But not stress.
Yeah, that's
and that's the big problem with Edwards' model. As we get to. But at those times, Flory and others knew about that.
Wait, I'm confused. If you allow them to contribute to the free energy, and if the free energy depends upon the strain, how can you not allow them to contribute to the strain?
Because of derivative. It has to. That's what Flory knew, and so that's what you do. Sorry, that's exactly the point that I want to make right now. It changes with deformation, but logarithmic derivative, if you have to design your this potential in such a way that when you take a derivative of free energy with respect to deformation, logarithmic derivative, the only contribution comes from this part. So this is actually a good problem. This is a problem. So let's do this problem. You have you have n monomers. You have another section of m monomers. You nail this part. You nail this part. And you calculate the free energy. So this is x1 and x2. You calculate the free energy of this chain. It's easy calculation. You know what it is. As a function of m and n, you calculate the stress as if you deform this by lambda. So you have lambda x1, lambda x2. You have m prime and n. And m prime is going to be m times lambda to some arbitrary power alpha. Alpha could be 0, so m doesn't change. Alpha could be 2, 3, 5, anything you like. You want to find the alpha, so when you calculate the free energy of the deformed chain, take a derivative with respect to lambda to calculate the stress would be the same coming only from this piece, as if it was stress in the whole thing and just in this piece are the same. There is no contribution to stress from this piece. And the answer to this problem, I can give you the, I mean, solution takes only 3 pages. But there is a simple transformation. We can do it. If you guess the answer right away, we can do it basically brute force by taking all the propagators, doing all the sum and everything. And the answer is alpha equals 2, which is what Floery put in his model. So there is a unique answer. There's only one way the potential can change. So there is no contribution from those virtual chains, virtual potential, to the stress of a network. This is a homework assignment. For those who want to do it, I have a solution. I can give out the solution for those who have trouble doing it. But
if you don't assume that it's a power law.
It doesn't matter what you assume. The power law is the only thing that works. I'm sure power law works. Now I haven't tested everything. Out of power laws, this is the only exponent that works. And that, so if that works, we can use it. Now I haven't proven that there could be some other function that may also work, but I doubt it. I don't think I think this is a unique answer.
Basically, you can always expand in a power series.
You can expand, you can show that this is the only, yeah.
The answer to that is, you can find other functions if you do the proof this way you were showing.
There is a way of doing proven. Actually, in appendix of the paper that I give you, there is a fancy way that Penyukov done this proven. I think you have a similar proof in your paper, where you're doing a transformation back to a different number of monomers. You change it out, and you can show that this is the only way you can transform back. I'll show you a bit later something similar, that you recover the free energy only part of the bare chain. So this is the sort of a naive way for me to see it over there. But there is a fancy transformation you can show that there is only, this is the only one transformation you can do to get the answer back.
Okay.
Yes?
You're trying to make the stress be the same as what? As the contribution of the strand in the middle under the same deformation, i.e.
Absolutely.
Not the strand with
M. Okay, what I'm doing is the following. I have this chain here. I can calculate how much stress is supported in the chain with M prime and N in the part N. This is another. This is much easier problem. You can find out what is the stress in the whole, what is the stress in the whole chain, and what is the stress in this part of the chain. We just did it in the previous page, remember? You know how much stress is supported by this piece. Then you start with this whole thing, and you want to go from here to here, take a derivative of energy, and make sure that stress at the end is what it would be that's supported just by this piece. But there is nothing else coming from that piece. So deformation of this thing doesn't contribute to stress. Does that answer your question? Not completely. Okay, good. Somehow people
there is some free energy change in both those.
Well, free energy changes, of course.
But monomers change in number, that's the thing.
Yes. Free energy.
The information in the virtual chains, the monomer do change.
That's our law. There is no real monomers in this potential. It's a potential that's getting softer, yeah. It's letting you go.
Equivalent.
That's why I call them virtual monomers, not real monomers.
But it's not really nailed X1. It's like there's a slip link there.
I'm sorry. No. Okay. There is a slip link to infinite dimensionality. There is something here to infinite dimensionality, and you add. No, there is no real slip link. You have to really. This is nailed here, and you have to really basically add monomers, like have a chemical potential or something else. You have to add monomers by brute force. There is no physics in this. Using that law.
So the N chain deforms non-affinely
under this. Well, it always deforms. Even if it's a phantom model, it deforms non-affinely. We've already gone through that.
Yeah.
Phantom model, the chain deforms non-affinely. Here, it deforms much more non-affinely. And so if you calculate this stress-strain relation, now what I'm showing is, so the stress in the affine and phantom model was proportional to this classical expression. So the Mooney stress, to see the difference, you divide the real stress by the classical value. And therefore, affine model, you just get kt per monomer, kt per chain. For the phantom, you have this extra prefactor that is maybe a half for functionality 4. And this way of doing it, which is the constrained junction model, you don't have a, so this is the answer for the affine model, when this parameter, this Mooney stress is exactly 1. This is the answer for the phantom model, where the Mooney stress is exactly a half. And now, depending on how soft or strong your additional potential is, which is defined by the ratio of number of monomers in your chain to the number of monomers in your additional virtual chains in the beginning. So if this number is very, very large, meaning that you have very, very short additional new chains, you're almost nailing it, then you can see that for large strengths of the confining potential, you're getting very close to the affine model, at least here. If this number is very, very small, meaning that your so confining potential is very soft, you're getting very close to the phantom result. And then you, since this number is changing, you're getting you're getting a non-classical expression for the constrained junction model. And I'm not going to comment about differences, dashed lines and solid lines. Basically, the solid line is our exact solution. Dashed line is the all approximation, but doesn't matter. Within the mean field theory, is exact solution. Now, the question on a quiz is, why is this ratio? So this is now, again, this is this Mooney ratio, which tells you how much strain softening you're getting. This is reciprocal extension. So going to the left, you're stretching your network. The question is, why is this Mooney ratio decreasing? Why are you getting strain softening as you're stretching your network from this model, before we go to entanglements? Anybody?
If you're softening the network, you're reeling in more monomers in the virtual chain.
The other way around. Remember? Yeah, exactly. As you're stretching, right, as you're stretching the network, your virtual chains get longer and longer and longer because of this m lambda square. And so effectively, potential gets softer and softer. So you're getting, as you stretch, this confining potential gets soft enough for you to be less and less confined. So you're allowed to fluctuate more because the potential is not as strong as you stretch.
Physically, how can we understand this?
We'll get to physical in about 20 minutes.
I mean, when you stretch, why would it fluctuate more?
Without entanglements, there is no physics in this model. I'm sorry. This is their attempt to describe entanglements.
In the phantom model,
there is no such effect. Phantom model gives you a straight line, and a fine model gives you a straight line. This is the constrained junction model that has this effect of softening of a potential as you stretch. Okay.
But absolute values are within a factor of 2 anyhow.
They cannot go between those two absolute limits. There is no way to get out of those limits, absolutely. So this is the problem, is because you only have junctions. The most you can do is to nail the junctions. And that's exactly the next point. So if you look at the experiments, you see that the modulus as a function of number density of chains doesn't go through zero. It goes as you dilute more and more, as you have longer and longer chains, the modulus goes to a finite number. And no way you can do nothing to the junctions to make that happen. It means that you have to constrain more than junctions to represent the effect of constraining of in a rubber. Okay? So that's where entanglements come in.
Michael, can you say anything about the slope in that graph? Does that agree with
Fortunately, there are not enough careful experiments to know the functionality of junctions that, I mean, Ralph have tried to look at the best set of data, and he's the best person to answer that. We've been arguing about that a lot. And the slope of that plot does not, it seems to be in, I don't want to comment on that. It's a question of functionality, and the two different experiments done presumably to the best way of doing it, and there are Gressley's argument of how to, what whose networks are cleanest. And the two set of experiments are not very consistent with each other. So I'm not sure I believe either of them until I see two sets repeating. But Ralph may comment better. I mean, he has done an analysis of the data. You want to comment on the slope?
Well, the real problem is you don't know what n is. Bill Gerson's idea is that the networks with the highest modulus are the ones that are the most perfect. But that's not necessarily true, because you could have other chemistry going on that makes them a lot smaller for those things, and then all bets are off.
I think the best answer is from simulations for, at this level, and I'm still waiting for somebody to do a simulation. I mean, so actually, the best comparison would be we did something with Ralph's data, and with the phantom, it looks like that, and with the entanglements, it looks like almost parallel but shifted. That's what you have in one of your plots. And the slopes sort of look reasonable. And it looks like phantom slope, but I don't know. I mean, that's. I think the simulation also have to be done much more carefully to what we've done so far, but it's doable, easier than experiments. Yep. So now, getting to, should I continue or is it?
Well, I think you need to continue. Yeah. Well, I mean,
if somebody wants to, got out, feel free to.
Well, depending on your discussion, half an hour.
Okay. So the next idea was came to introduce that the actual entanglements have to do with something work acting not only on the cross links, but throughout the whole chain. And so the topological constraints. This is sort of all the story about tube. And so this is the tube model. In fact, it's already corrected tube model from Edwards, from 67. Effectively, you can represent your tube by potential acting on all the monomers of your chain. So instead of adding potential, this virtual potential, only at the ends, you can have it act on all the monomers. Now, where Edwards went wrong was exactly the point that you made, is that the points of attachment of this potential are not where your chain will be. So the point of attachment of this potential are not along the primitive paths of your tube. They are very, 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 very far. And they have to be done in such a way, and it's a very simple way to figure out how, so the actual, the chain itself stays as a random walk. But the idea of attaching potential to every monomer is this 67 paper by Edwards.
Is it every monomer or every several monomers?
Every monomer. The Edwards did it in every monomer.
Not every n monomer.
No, it's a cube.
Very good question. That's what we're going to talk about next. So you can, the idea of topological potential is to restrict fluctuation of monomers of the test chain to some mean square distance. Instead of having fluctuation of the size of the whole chain, you want to fluctuate to some distance A, which is going to be your tube diameter. Now, how can you do it? You can either attach this virtual n-mers to a test chain every n monomers apart. So you can have this small n and capital N. You can have this capital N equals 1 or capital N equals NE, anything in between. In fact, one can solve this problem, which is a comb polymer nailed at the ends of the teeth of the comb to the background, and find out what is the mean square fluctuation of a backbone. And you can find this answer. This is the mean square fluctuation of a backbone is a geometric mean of number of monomers in a strand between attachments and the size of the teeth, virtual chains. So this is the gauge invariance in the theory. You can have your capital N being 1 and small n being NE square. So these things would be extremely long. They're going to be NE square. And then you have the same fluctuations of the chain monomers. You attach every monomer, but very, very, very soft potential. Or you attach every second monomer, but potential which is twice as stiff. And you keep on doing it. And until your, as long as your attachment potential is softer than the strand, so all of those monomers will fluctuate the same amount, you're okay. Now, if you're going to be attaching very far apart, your junction points would be fluctuating less, and you will have a non-uniform tube, and you don't want to do that. So there is a limit to where you want to use this gauge invariance to have uniform tube. And within that limit, it doesn't matter how you split it. Adverse to every monomer. Any questions on this model? So this is basically, from my point of view, a next step extension from constrained junction.
What you just explained is independent on where you put the nails?
Well, you have to put the nails in such a way. Yeah, yes, of course. For fluctuations, for fluctuations, it doesn't matter where you put the nails because mean square. Oh, yes, this is Gaussian chains fluctuate if you squeeze them into a point or stretch them to the size of the universe. The mean square fluctuations don't change. This is only fluctuations. I'm not talking about distance between points.
Right, but does it assume that you nail it regularly?
No.
Every second or every third month.
No.
You can't pick.
No.
There's no fluctuation.
As long as fluctuation between junction is less than this parameter, much less this parameter, is fine. If you have a strand here much longer than any between points of attachment, then you'll fail. As long as you have your randomness is contained in such a way that the largest loops. Strands with no attachments are less than this A, because you can do it in general. You can add fluctuations of this thing, and this is exactly a solvable model. I'm giving a specific answer, but I have an exact answer for you.
It should be so fluctuations should be much smaller than the mean.
Right. Okay. Fluctuations of the strands between attachments.
Which is not true for slipping model. That's what I.
Right. No, it's not. It's you have to yes. Slip, you get a factor of two corrections if you're going to be doing it that way. Yeah. So now the question is what do you do? And the adverts, what do you do with n? If n, small n, its potential doesn't change with deformation, you get the classical adverts model. And following from that, all the other logical models, but they violate the microscopic definition of stress. There is a stress. If you calculate it properly, there is a stress supported by the virtual chains, which is not physical. Stress can only be supported by real material, not by virtual material. So what happens if you actually use the Fourier expression or classical expression for and allow if you deform this tube by factor of lambda, what you're doing is you're moving those nail points. Now, where do you attach the nail points? You attach the nail points in such a way that for any strand of real chain and two virtual chains, the distribution, probability distribution of this end-to-end vector is a Gaussian. If you do that, then no matter which way you go, the chain itself will be always Gaussian. So this is how to do attachment. That basically answers one of your questions you had in the beginning. Where to put my nails?
Well, I mean, I know.
Good.
I think as well with the modes. The tricky bit is if they can slip along the chain, then this is not talking anymore.
If this can slip. No, this is the moment of creation of the network. Yes.
Stupid question. I see. You say you don't want these virtual chains to give you any contribution to the stress.
Right.
Is that the same as saying, though, that there can't be an entanglement contribution to the stress? I mean, these things...
No. Wait a second. What it's saying, they contribute to entropy, and they contribute to entropy of your main chain. So, of course, the fact that they're there changes the stress. But the stress can only be held by the chain itself. But of course, the fact that there are entanglements changes the stress characteristics, and you don't get the otherwise going to be phantom always. So yes, they affect the entropy, they affect free energy, but they don't support stress.
And the physical effect that they are mimicking also cannot support stress.
Right. Right, because you're going to be doing double counting.
Yeah.
Okay. This is the most important point, actually, of the whole story. The rest is math.
If you want to use the Atlas expression for the stress, you should not use the Atlas.
Right. Exactly. 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 Exactly.
So you say, okay, so Edwards does not. Oh, I'm sorry. Edwards actually does include the contribution of the stress from these small chains?
Yes.
From these fictitious?
Yes.
Which is just wrong.
Yes.
Without knowing, of course.
Well, I mean, yes, apparently Flory at the same time did try it, but he was doing the other part wrong. So if they talk to each other decently, they will get it done in the 60s. It's, all of the pieces are already there. I mean, basically two.
Flory is this confinement idea, right? For the classical people, it's 10 years after Edwards. It's just that they take this confinement idea of Edwards and apply it to the only model they know, which is the one which only has the cross.
I'm sorry. This constraint junction model is the same.
Yeah, it's from
77. Yeah, ten years later, right? 10 years after, right? I agree. Yes, sorry. Yes, I agree.
No,
that's absolutely true.
Yeah.
Edwards could have done it easily.
Yes.
Okay. So. Yes. Yes. The switchboard model. Yes. So now it's slightly to the math. So we have our non-affine tube where these virtual chains chain the number of monomers, the virtual chains chain proportional to the square of deformation, while the real chains, of course, don't. And in fact, for convenience, we can attach every NE, but it's actually not quite right. You have to attach more frequently than every NE to do it slightly better. This model, there is a gauge invariance, so it doesn't matter. So you remember that this equation that we talked about, the mean square fluctuation, the tube diameter, is proportional to the geometric mean of those two numbers. If you multiply this by that, take square root, you find out the mean square lambda changes linearly with, mean square tube diameter changes linearly with lambda, or tube diameter proportional to square root of lambda in this model. That's basically a straightforward result from those two things. Okay. And yes. Okay, sure.
So you have square number of monomers in a virtual spring.
Change in proportional to lambda square. Number of monomers in a strand doesn't change. So the product.
It's square, one square root of lambda.
Okay.
But when you say the confining cube performs affinely, Ralph would talk a little bit of that because. But you might equally well say the confining constraints, the nail points, do deform.
Oh, the nails deform affinely, but what I mean, we probably have different definition of a tube. My view of a tube is what you would see if you make a photograph of your snake, or where the monomers are fluctuating. What is the mean square fluctuation of monomers?
That's what Ralph calls a sausage. Sorry, we had this again last week.
We agree on the picture. I just, the terminology we have to get straightened, but I don't know if you...
The important physical assumption is in the upper left, the n goes as lambda squared.
It's not assumption, it's derived from the macroscopic definition of stress. There is no other, I mean, we discussed already, there is no other way you can have, in this model here, little toy model, there is no other way you can have this virtual chain, the potential chain, change so the stress would not be supported only by the real chain.
Yeah, I'm not sure what I'm saying. Basically, what you're doing is trying to model the intramolecular the correlation function for a single chain.
I'm doing it like
in the fluid. And in the fluid, you'd say I have a microscopic expression for the stress from the conformations, the contribution to the stress from one chain. And I mimic that it's single chain correlation function, however I want, whatever artifices I want to represent the two. But then I use the microscopic expression for the stress, the Floyd-Hardy theory for the stress to calculate it. There's no notion of free energy in that argument.
Sorry, no, I'm doing something different. I'm saying I'm taking free energy of the chain, and I'm taking derivative of free energy of the chain to calculate macroscopic stress.
Including these fictitious chains.
Including everything. And I'm saying that the only way this derivative would give me the same answer as the microscopic definition of stress is when this exponent alpha is equal to 2.
Since these other chains are just mathematical objects that you've stuck in to represent the confinement
potential, right. So what I'm saying is the only way the confining potential would not support itself stress, which is I have a chain and a potential. the stress can only be held by the chain, not by potential.
I'm saying, how do you know that this is a real free energy? Why should I attach anything? If these things were inserted in order to...
Oh, okay, I'm sorry, yes. This is a model. Let me go back to the story.
And you did go over this, but...
No, that's fine. This is fine. This is very important. So let's say that we are talking about the tube model. Tube model is... Thank you. I'm not throwing it yet. Tube model is that you have a chain in a confining potential. This is an assumption. You're assuming that you have a single... You represent topological effects of surrounding chain by putting some kind of confining potential on your chain. And so you can write a free energy, which Edwards did, for the chain and the potential. That is the model. From that, everything else is math. If you agree with that model, then this is the only conclusion you can have.
I think what you've done is you've written down a potential main force for a single chain, right? But all you're trying to do is to describe the motion of one strand.
I'm describing the entropy of one chain strand, not the motion of one strand. Free energy of one chain.
You're describing the probability distribution for a single chain.
In a potential.
And you're using a potential to confine it.
Exactly. So that's the tube.
It's not clear. You have a mechanical definition of the stress, the contribution of the stress from that strand, which is unambiguous, right?
I have a definition of the stress, which is a microscopic definition that can only be held by the chain itself.
Right.
Okay. That's microscopic. Then I have my free energy.
How do I put this? Is there really a clean argument that says you should differentiate the potential mean force for the single chain in order to get a stress?
Yes.
Or is that just sort of sounds...
No. Right? No, you can do a free energy of your whole system,
okay,
and you can show that the stress is a derivative of energy with respect to deformation. That's a theorem of continuum whatever.
That's certainly true, but you've now integrated out all the other chains in the system. It's not.
That's a separate two things. There is a model which says that my model is that I have I can represent my whole mass of many chains in a network by an ensemble of individual chains that are placed in a confining potential. That is an assumption. That's the only assumption I'm making, nothing else.
Okay, I guess what I'm saying is a more conservative assumption might be, and what I thought you were doing, was saying that it's not a model for the free energy, it's a model for the single chain probability distribution.
I don't see the difference. Can you tell me? If you're talking about entropy.
That everything is entropic.
Right. The assumption is that I have only entropy contribution to. That was in the very, very first slide. Remember.
Mean field potential could also contribute.
The very, very, very first assumption was that elasticity is purely entropic. That was the assumption of the thing. Then I'm saying that if I know the entropy of my chain and how it changes upon deformation, that I know everything about my system.
You simply want this potential to still give you the stress coming from...
Absolutely.
The chain.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But it's a different potential with respect, say, liquid crystals.
Of course.
Might also contribute to stress.
Sure.
The potential cannot contribute to stress because it's purely entropic.
Right.
Okay. The reason I'm suspicious is because, when I thought about the business of a semi-flexible chain in the tube, I thought through this a little bit and decided that if I made similar arguments, I could get really screwed up answers. That is... For instance, you have a semi-flexible chain in a tube.
Is this any flexible chain a pure entropic object?
No, it's not. There's nothing. It doesn't. He's got free energies. There's nothing essential about the fact that it's a pure thing.
There is an energetic. No.
There is an essential difference that mean field potential, internal mean field potential, can contribute to stress in case the mean field is not purely entropic. That's the case for liquid crystals.
Suppose I have a chain in a tube, and I do something that I widen the tube a little bit. I change the free energy of confinement of the chain in the tube in some way. I get a contribution to the free energy of order kT per collision of the walls of the chain with the tube. It's there even in equilibrium that I would have even if I did an isotropic expansion. But if you look at the microscopic expression for the stress in this example, you find it's traceless. That is, you find that one argument says you have a giant osmotic pressure even in an equilibrium, and another argument tells you that you have no osmotic pressure at all in equilibrium because you have infinitely thin strands. So
I'm not sure what you mean by collisions with walls of the tube. Okay. You're putting something else in beyond a simple potential in this thing. Do you really have chain in? Can you write a Hamiltonian for your collision?
I won't be able to make this argument concretely because it was a somewhat convoluted line of reasoning. But I just think that going from a description of a single chain probability distribution to a macroscopic free energy is delicate, and I'll just leave it there.
In this case, it's completely unambiguous as far as I know, because I know the energy. But maybe is there other contributions to the besides entropy that I agree with you. Okay.
You're suffering only two within an isotopic.
Which might be the case today, because what you mean by a collision is a little place where the constraints impose bending energy. That's where that just comes
from. No, I'm saying the example was if I had, actually, I can't give you this example, maybe it is concrete enough. Imagine a chain in a tube, and you do an isotropic expansion of the system. The free energy of the potential, the confinement potential widens, it has to.
Yes.
And so if you do, if I calculate the free energy of the chain of potential, then I'm tempted to say that the free energy of the system has gone down. Okay, which said that I had an osmotic pressure in equilibrium, but where in fact I didn't.
No, no. Well, I mean,
anyway,
I think it's beyond this point. So the you can either attach this longer virtual chains to the same points every n e, or using this gauge invariance, split this n square into n and n, and attach virtual chains with lambda n in e, every lambda n e along, and you'll get again the same description of your model because of this effective gauge invariance. And what it means is that the trajectory of the chain, or the affine strand, is now has a length of 3 or what the lambda n e. So the affine strand in this tube is not n e, but because the potential is changed by a factor of lambda squared, depending on what we talk about the fluctuation of this chain, the affine strand becomes lambda n e. Now comes the physics. Why is this happening in entanglement? So let's try to argue why this could be. Mathematically, it's rigorously proven. Now we can explain why mathematics are giving that. If you look at fluctuations of the affine strand, if this is your affine strand, the fluctuation of affine strands are exactly the tube diameter. So if you have a affine strand, and you look at how much, at what length scales, you can actually define a trajectory, how far it's confined. The affine strand is defined in such a way, and you can do it mathematically, show what it is, but that the tube diameter is exactly of the size of fluctuation of your affine strand. That's one theory, that one connection. There is a second connection. So this is one sort of closure of logic. There is a second connection. Let's look, see at the size of the affine strand.
So if you just say,
okay. Sure. Sorry. So, do you understand how we derive the fine the fine strand?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Sure.
How do you define A?
This A is defined right here. Is the mean square fluctuations of the monomer. It's of real chain. It's always defined of real chain. I'm talking about a fine strand of a real chain.
Okay, in perpendicular direction or in any direction?
Okay, this picture is done isotropically, but if you want to think of tensorial, think about everything in x, y, and z, and I have lambda x, lambda y, lambda z, and a would be a x, a y, and z, because lambdas are different, a's are different.
So it's in direction of deformation.
Yes. Exactly. So this is all of this is done in direction. I'll split it in three directions in two slides. Right now it's uniform for simplicity pictures. So you have an affine strand, and the fluctuations of that affine strand are confined by the tube. And so this is they have the size of the tube. The second closure comes when you talk about entanglements. So let's look at the size of the affine strand. Since that's many monomers in it, and it deforms the Finley, its size is proportional to lambda 3/2 in the extension direction. And on larger, so this is something called affine lengths. On lengths bigger than that, everything is continuum elasticity. On lengths smaller than that, you're just pulling one chain, your test combined chain. of a strand of your fine strand. Now, yes. Oh, because the fine strand has lambda n monomers. This is its unperturbed size, and it deforms the finless, so you multiply by lambda. This is its size before deformation, b square root of lambda n e, and it deforms the finless, so you get extra lambda. Lambda times square root of lambda gives you lambda.
Before deformation, lambda was 1.
No. This is the length, I mean, the affine strand changes with deformation. Before deformation, lambda was 1, and so the affine strand is a bare tube diameter. Now, if I deform, my affine strand gets lambda n e, and that many monomers before deformation, monomers lambda n e, that many monomers of my chain, had this size. And now, after I deform, if I label those, paint those monomers red, lambda n e monomers paint red, that's their size before deformation, that's their size after deformation. So this is their fine length scale, okay?
For this chain, when you say the length scale beyond which is...
For this network.
It's still within this single chain.
Yeah, I mean this is the model that all, this is the mean field model where all chains are do the same thing in the mean field potential when you average of all possible statistics. Yes, so yes, if I want to do scattering, I have to worry about if I label deuterium, I have to do scattering, I have to worry about fluctuations. But on average, a fine strand does that.
Well, should you think about that length scale being different
from long versus? Absolutely. It's a tensor. And so now let's look at the entanglement. So now we have a fine strand that has lambda and e monomers, but our entanglement strand, n e, is still bare n e. We don't change the number of entanglements. So let's calculate how much is the entanglement strand of an e monomer stretched. This is the affine strand size times what Fever fraction. We already talked about that. If you have a large strand stretched, the distance of a smaller subchain is just proportional to the fraction of the chain, of the affine strand that is entanglement part. And that's exactly tube diameter. So this is the second closure of the logic. Fluctuations of monomers of a test chain are limited by the distance between entanglements. There's nothing else. So just by using these two assumptions, saying that distance between entanglements have to be limiting fluctuation of a fine strand, you can derive everything without any math. If you say that I have some affine strand, that's, for example, I'm stretching, and the fluctuations of monomers in this affine strand are limited by the distance between entanglements, and distance between entanglements is stretched as well because I'm stretching the whole thing. If I say that fluctuations of affine strand are limited by distance between entanglements, I'm going to derive 3/2 and 1/2 and everything just by disclosure of logic. It's not real. So this is basically trying to put some hand-waving physics on the mathematical result.
For the hand-waving.
Okay.
But if you remember, some of the data I was showing was just about that. It was about the internal deformation of long paths and through networks measured and then sort of rescaled as a function of the tube diameter, in Michael's language, parallel and perpendicular to the elongation and the crossover from phantom to affine behavior, and I could sort of superimpose all data.
You're using exactly the scaling.
And that is.
This is a bit numerical confirmation. Yeah.
We use a different language, but we check that.
Yeah. It's consistent with numerical simulation as well.
It comes off.
Okay. So now the free energy again, starting with the Gaussian network, we already went through that. Now we have to say that we have entangled network, and in a stretched direction. You have that much of, this is your free energy per affine strand. Affine strand is lambda n e. So you use this classical expression of stretching of an affine strand, and the contribution for stretching is now linear in lambda, not quadratic in lambda. This is a very big mathematical difference, that you have to calculate per your affine strand, and your affine strand is changing on you as you deform. So this is one piece of different physics. Second piece comes here in a compressed direction. Your strand is still lambda n e, but what happens, and you cannot really keep your oil, this goes back to Pina's picture of second version of CCR. As you are compressing, you really are not, remember I said you can attach potential to every monomer, every other monomer, and more and more loosely, and you can attach it to every any monomer. So that's okay if you are stretching. If you're compressing, you shouldn't have gone that far. You should have stopped earlier, because when you're compressing, chain suddenly remembers that there are chains that are farther away from it that are now coming in, and you have to keep actually more dense, because the affine strain now becomes less than E. Lambda is less than 1. Affine strain less than E, so you have to really keep. Remember, you have this condition that you cannot have your virtual chain cannot be shorter than your network chain. So you have to keep the attach. You have to keep attaching more, so the chain gets folded back and back in. So it's as if slip links or entanglements appear that were not there before. It comes out of this math straightforwardly. Okay, that as you're compressing, what is happening in the compressed direction is that you're folding your chain back and back and back in, and the actual affine distance, tube diameter, still square root of lambda times, but it's now smaller. And the only way the chain can be smaller is you can keep folding it back. So you add more and more. Effectively, as if you're adding more and more, if you think of them as actual points, if you think about the continuous potential, you're not really doing anything. You're just making your potential stiffer. Because lambda gets smaller, those you're actually having shorter number of monomers, fewer monomers, and the potential gets stiffer, which is actually making the tube fold back, chain fell back in the tube. Okay, so the total free energy is the sum of, this is a simple crossover expression, so sum of the two terms, one lambda and one over lambda. And you can add the phantom term to it if you like. This is basically the okay. This is the Edwards tube model.
Why do you sum?
Why do I sum what?
Lambda and one
over lambda. Oh, okay. This is a crossover between, for very large lambda, this is the right behavior.
Oh, okay.
Very small lambda is the same, so I'm just basically trying to match up a very simple crossover between two limits. This is not rigorous. This is just to get a simple mathematical answer at the end. That is true, correct in the limits. And then you can calculate analytically the Mooney stress, which has, in this non-affine tube model, has this form. It's I remind you, in Edwards tube model, it's still classical. You have Platon modulus of due to crosslinks. So it's modulus due to crosslinks and due to entanglements. Here we have the contribution from crosslink is still classical. Contribution to entanglements has this non-classical form. And this, again, comes from just taking derivative of free energy and dividing stress by the classical term. Well, the definition of the crosslink modulus is basically the classical phantom one. It's the kt per crosslink times 1 minus 2 over f. It's a classical phantom definition. And here the definition of this modulus comes from exactly what you how you define your potential. It has to do with this NE of a potential mean square fluctuation in a starting point. You can calculate it. I'm not giving you an answer because if you add slip links, the coefficient changes. But it's effectively kt per knit times a number. Okay, so this is the comparison of the simple theory with the data. For example, if you take that two fitting parameters, there is a plateau contribution, entanglement contribution, and then there are three contributions because this is done at the same concentration. So presumably the number of entanglements is the same. What you're changing is the crosslink density by changing the radiation. I think this is not the design network that cure at different levels. So you can fit with just one plateau value and three different crosslink values. So these numbers are proportional to the amount of cure. And you fit this, again, this is the Mooney plot of deviation from classical theory as a function of reciprocal lambda. So within this range, it seems like the model seems to work. You can do it comparison with the simulations. This is older data, set of data. Now we have much better set of data from, again, this Mooney plot, three different networks, chains of a different number of crosslinks, between number one between crosslinks. And again, you're doing this fit with single entanglement parameter and three different crosslink parameters, and it seems to be fitting relatively well.
Well, the problem is,
yes,
you would say in your theory that the classical contribution is just the phantom number. Right? That is so.
Classical contribution.
If you go back to your previous slide, you had.
I have the crosslink contribution and entanglement contribution.
The crosslink contribution is just the phantom number.
Right.
Now, if I look at your numbers, then this should be just the factor of 4 between.
Well, you have to look at the right number, density of volume fraction, and number of dead ends, number of trifacts that are functional. If you plug it all in, it doesn't agree. Well, if you just use the phantom value, if you calculate it straight from here and use this number, they don't agree.
They don't agree.
No.
And so that is sort of part of something I said. I mean, that's sort of part of the way you do the theory, right? Because you only worry about one strand between the chains. Well, if you write down sort of this model of virtual chains for a network with arbitrary connectivity, then we can solve it sort of formally exactly with this mode. And then what you see is that these two effects sort of what the entanglement contribution depends on the network connectivity.
Not on the mean field level. Not on the mean field level.
I mean, it's the exact solution of that very model. So I think that's what we're talking about.
And what about the disappearance of the reciprocal term?
Yes, that
in the presence of
dilution. Yeah, that model reproduces that relatively well with dilution, because you, as you dilute, you basically this lambda becomes larger and larger and larger, and effectively your confining potential gets smaller and smaller and smaller and disappears. That's the same idea, exactly.
In such can't you measure in simulations two terms separately?
They could, but they haven't.
So you allow going chains through each other, and you measure only. Contribution from junction points, and then you fit it. So you find modulus in this way, and then you prohibit it, and you have only one fitting parameter.
And the other thing is that in small MCs, I don't believe that the real ME is unaffected. That's a
small MC, when you mean very short.
The more you cross link it, I believe the effective ME increases.
Yeah, I don't.
So there should be a coupling with
the. I don't know how you define ME, but that's a separate issue. I think the crossover between the two cases where you have one entanglement per crosslink and one crosslink per entanglement, this crossover, the whole model is not very valid. This model is done in a limit of very long strands between entanglements, where you really have strong entanglement strands, and then the contribution from crosslink should be very weak. And this limit, I think the model works much better.
So this double tube model tries to do the crossover, and then you will see that
if
you go to very short strands relative to entanglement, that the entanglement contribution vanishes, even without this assumption that it is sort of dilute, that there may be even less.
Yeah.
Let's say sort of this GE parameter, the strength is always the same. And then so if you see that in the limit when the strands become very short, you just go back to the phantom model, because the intrinsic fluctuations of the model of this network are so small that they don't see this entanglement, which is much larger, so they are not affected.
Yeah,
and in the other limit, it crosses over to what sort of this model B, how I call it. Sort of.
I don't think the double tube models occur, but you can talk about it separately. I think they have the wrong limit. If you take mean field limit, where there should be, the two models should agree, they don't. So one of them must be wrong, and this is the right one in the mean field limit. So something
is. Go to that model in the limit where the strands become very long, and where you say your model should hold. I mean, that's what comes out of the theory. Your theory in that limit. And it has to cross over.
To the phantom.
It has some encoder crossover.
Okay. Okay, so this model, if you do simulation of contraction, this line is the Mooney-Rivlin expression, which is supposedly a straight line. This is the simulation data, and the model shows deviation from Mooney-Rivlin expression towards the data, but it's not as strong as it should be. So you can see that if you do real experiments of very strong contraction, there is a maximum, and the model misses it. So there is something still missing in the model, and that was missing in the old Edwards model, and that's the fact that the potential was attached to the monomers in all three directions, and there was not any slippage between along the tube. So all of the fluctuation modes and all those things are not.
It looks like there's an awful lot of scattering.
Yes, that's extremely noisy. That's very old data, but that's true for most data. So
if you need to get to the case.
Pardon?
Yeah, so Fred, carry on. I mean, if you want to hear about the slipping.
Okay. Okay. So, let me. Okay, so this is the model that we just described, where you have a single chain with cross links that is attached. You have this potential that's attached to every point or every other point, every p monomers apart, to the back to the non-fluctuating network, elastic network, and. I'm going to skip all of this stuff. We already went through that. This is basically the expression for the free energy comparison of the phantom and affine. And we went through that, so we're going to skip this slide. The slip link, a slip tube model, is exactly the same as the other model. And all you are adding is you're allowing these attachment points to freely slide along the tube, or you're allowing the chain to freely slide across the attachment points. So, again, all the description we had before with the attaching the other end of the virtual chains, which is your confining potential, to the non-fluctuating background is still valid. The change of the number of monomers in the virtual potential chains with deformation in all three directions differently with lambda square is still valid. The only mode that you're adding is the slip mode. That this point of attachment is not fixed on the chain, it can redistribute. It can slide back and forth. So that's a different, this is a change of the.
So your algorithm of placing this virtual spring should change? And you allow it to slip?
No. At the moment of preparation, you are basically starting with a given conformation or position of those slip links, and it could be the same exactly as before. So the potential is the same. Slip links represent potential. What is the mode that's allowed, you think about the potential is like a well, and the chain is allowed to slide back and forth in this well, but the well is the same. So for any given position of the chain, the potential is still the same. So if you're not changing the potential, we're not changing if you want to attach, are you following what I'm saying?
Can you guarantee again that statistics will be Gaussian?
At the moment of preparation, the statistics is Gaussian, and then if the chain moves slides in and out, and depending what in an entropic way, that it will stay Gaussian.
Fine. I think that is solved.
Pardon me?
I mean, if you apply this recipe, and now let's just talk. That's applied to a ring polymer. So we at t equals zero, we prepare it in the old way with the fixed links, mm-hmm. right? And we choose to correct statistics, whatever. Mm-hmm. Then we let go. Now the condition is that if we calculate time averages for mm-hmm. given realizations of the
sure.
point, and then the ensemble averages over this.
Oh, it's going to be different. It's going to do whatever it can within the potential it is. Yeah.
Yeah, but sort of what one has to show is that sort of at the end of that procedure, you have to get back a Gaussian ring statistics.
Not within a fixed preparation condition.
The double average, like I said.
For the double average, you have to get
double average. Of course, it does, and here does as well. Because the point is that when the chain slides through and the position of the slip link is slightly different, it is the same as if it were in a different. If you have an ensemble of one preparation, mm-hmm. and you look at a different element of ensemble with slightly slided thing, mm-hmm. those two could be perfectly identical.
I think that is not. That needs to be proved.
That's the condition of preparation.
We allow for fluctuations of number of monomers between slip links.
Yes.
And so it can make one loop, and then two slip links can collide, and it makes a loop, and all these complications which we saw from Greco and J. Schieber model. You change statistics, right, by allowing to slip.
I'm not allowing the slip links to slide through each other.
No, yes, I know, but you allow them to aggregate.
And I'm allowing the slip links as a perfect ideal gas along the chain.
Yeah.
And if I, in my initial preparation condition, I place them as an ideal gas, the statistics of slip links along the chain in a preparation condition and during the dynamics doesn't change.
We couple to the chain statistics, right? And you remember I asked you the question that you place this regular?
Before
you place junctions regularly. You say that fluctuations should be smaller than distance, right?
Right.
Now this is not true anymore because the fluctuations of distance between slip links will be much larger than average distance.
Not much larger.
Yes, they will be.
Between slip links?
Yeah.
No. In ideal gas.
So can you prove it?
Yes, the average distance, I can prove it by just giving this answer from ideal gas, one dimensional ideal gas.
Yeah, but it's an ideal gas which couples to elastic degree of freedoms which are in the chain, right? If the chain is there, then it has this, you prepare it with the fixed links, and then it would be in some kind of elastic equilibrium.
No, you can solve for the free, you put the, right, the free energy. Which is the free energy of slip links plus the free energy of keys. Let me show you the free
energy. You don't have to do it on the basis of the free energy. There you can get out anything. You have to do it on the basis of
conformations. No, but the conformation of the chain is in the free energy as well.
Yeah, okay, but that's just one number, and the conformation is a lot more complicated. I mean, I don't.
What is there? What else is there?
Well, I mean, the whole conformation, it contains more information than just an average free energy.
But I think you don't need this. One dimensional gas of slip links.
Mm-hmm. The average distance.
The average
fluctuation is of the order of average distance between two molecules, okay. which is a what distance between slip links.
So your potential for the slip link is essentially cylindrical. It doesn't go.
Exactly.
It's not a trap.
Exactly.
The average fluctuation is the same as average distance, right?
Right.
That's my point.
Right.
And before you say that it should be much smaller than the average distance for your construction to be valid.
What should be much smaller?
Average fluctuation of distance between slip links before.
I didn't say that. I said fluctuations of the monomers on the chain should be much smaller, not the distance between slip links. No.
Number of monomers between two slip links.
You're going to have to carry on.
Okay.
The beginning of the debate is important to hear, but I think possibly the end of it is
not. Okay. So I think there is not no time. I'll just outline, but I will not take you to the mathematical derivation. The idea here is that you need to allow the number of monomers in a given direction to change. So you have the and this is the initial number of monomers in the x, y, and z direction. G is how much is the times that is the new number of monomers in direction. The total sum has to be conserved because you don't change total number of monomers, but your monomers are slipping from tube in one direction to the tube in another direction. So you have to now have number of monomers in a given direction of a tube is different than before. You can then do a renormalization back to defining new effective monomers that are changed from that by the coefficient.
But the monomers along the test chain, right? Not along the anchor chains.
These are real monomers. Real monomers, and I'm describing how it slips.
Yes.
If you have you're stretching it one way, the tube is get this way and compact the other way, and I'm allowing the monomers to redistribute from the contraction direction to the elongation directions. Okay. And this G parameter tells you what fraction of monomers slips across. And then you just do a trivial renormalization of number of monomers and reduce the problem back to the old problem, but with new renormalized monomers. And you also and that ends up to renormalizing lambda in a given direction, but the square root of number of of this slip parameter. Because to keep the free energy the same after renormalization, you have to make it basically lambda, the stretching times the old monomer length is the same as the new stretching times the new monomer length. And so by doing that, you have, this is the old free energy that we had before in the old model. The only new term that we're adding that's non-trivial is the entropy of slip links, the ideal gas entropy of slip links. And then you just minimize the free energy, and you get an answer. This is the, you can get, do it in different expansion. You cannot. You can find answer to some any accuracy by expansion, or you can do numerical solution of your equation. So this is, for example, the amount of slip as a function of for small deformations. The Mooney ratio is still going to be of the sum of the cross link and entanglement. The cross link is the phantom one, the entanglement one is now Kt per Ne with this coefficient for sevenths. This is the asymptotic behavior of this Mooney ratio for large extension and large compractions. And then, let me show you. So this is what happens with the slip. This is the number amount of monomer sliding from one direction to another. You, as a function of, as you're extending, which is going to 1 over lambda, decreasing 1 over lambda, you get more and more and more monomers going in, into your stretch direction.
But this is lambda z.
This thing, no.
Lambda z.
This, yes, this is 1 over lambda z, yes, thank you. And as you contract, you're pushing out of monomers from your contraction direction. So this, this curve tells you the distribution of monomers. The solid line here is, an, is a solution of minimization of free energy for this Mooney stress. And the dashed line is our simplified fit with the, this expression here, which is basically we cooked up as a crossover expression to fit our exact new, exact solution. That for simplicity is convenient for that. So this is basically the summary of the result. And this is the comparison with data, finally. So what you have now is we, all the data we could collect that of a large enough extent of deformation. This is Mooney stress as a function of deformation. This is natural rubber at PDMS, different sets of data. And we are doing two-parameter fit with GC and GE. Now what we can do from that fit is subtract GC from this data, divide by GE, and we should get a universal curve. So this is basically taking the data, subtracting what we believe is the contribution from crosslink, divided by what we believe contribution from entanglements, and all the data from basically a bunch of experiments we found literature and experiments, computer simulations from different number of crosslinks, all seem to be fitting within noisy within the data, with all this our exact result or our numerical fit of this result with no adjustable parameters.
0.1 to 10.
Huh? 0.1 to 10, right? Because if this is the range of extension people could was developed. Notice that the change of this thing is much bigger than junction on any of the junction model could do because they can only allow the change of factor of 2, going from affine to phantom. This change is much more. This ratio changes by more than that. Okay. So that's the end of the story. So this is the summary of the ideas. Of you have the adverse tube model. Virtual chains connect many monomers on network to non-fluctuating background. The constrained junction model fluctuations change affinely with deformation. And you allow distribution of the slip links. So those are the three main ideas. The confining potential, the potential changes with deformation, and the slippage across. Thanks.
Take longer than we hope, but I don't think it would have been useful to have tried to cut any of that out. Manfred has about half an hour of stuff to contribute to this. So
definitely.
We choose to do that now, or we could.
No, I think you could
maybe schedule it.
Are we sure we have the room?
Oh, not until this afternoon for that matter. Well, Manfred, I do apologize for that, but we can say it's not a conference. And
Yeah, sure. No problem. But it would be nice to have it now, in my opinion.
Well, should I just start? Well,
yeah. At least let's give it a start.
Yeah. Okay, would you like to do that?
Yeah.
We'll start at least. Let me just find out if we don't
like
it.
Yeah, it would be.
Yeah. The room's probably fine, but.
I think it's fine. Let me just check to see whether it is. So we'll get to
that. What I would show you is something. More elaborate than I just told you. My interest in this subject came, of course, from the side of the melts, when I realized that effectively plotting the stress-strain relations of rubber is a way to plot a damping function, as we do it for polymer melts. It's exactly the same formalism. And this is when I started to think about rubbers, because as who mentioned that, Rolf, I think we should first understand rubbers. Maybe we don't have fluctuations and constraint release, reptation, before we go on to understand melts. Now, the I have tried to bring my ideas in a few statements, very simple statements. Much simpler than what you just heard from Mike. Certainly not as elaborate. But what I would like to show you is that you don't need really two parameters, GC and GE, to understand networks. But for networks where the modulus is below the plateau modulus of the corresponding melt, you just need one. The idea is the following. Let's first define what an entanglement is. If you don't have tubes anymore, at least we should clarify what we understand by an entanglement. Now, if we have a chain in a confining potential or a box with a diameter a sub zero, and this might be a slip link or a cross link, I don't care about that at that moment, then the free energy over 3 kT is half the end-to-end distance, r zero squared, divided by n sub zero monomers with Kuhn step b, plus what comes from the confinement here, a half nb squared n sub zero here, divided by a sub zero squared. Now, there is certainly a natural diameter a here in the material, as in any melt. Yeah. So we minimize this energy of that segment here, and say dv dn sub zero is equal to zero. That gives us n sub zero over r sub zero is equal to a sub zero over b squared. That's the conventional result from Doy Edwards 78. Okay? And then let's call the free energy of one entanglement equal to 3 kT. Then we have a recipe which gives us the diameter of the tube, a sub c squared is equal to n sub c b squared. And of course, the length here, r sub zero, turns out to be just a sub zero. I think no argument here. Now, upon deformation, let's assume that the total energy of the network then would be 3 kT times the number of segments. Okay? We can measure that by the modulus. Now, the second step is let's deform the network. And we deform the strand, and we assume that all strands are deformed in the same way. Okay? So we make a mean field approach and say, now, to deform this thing, even if this is a crosslink here, what is necessary is to squeeze it. So there is a diameter A, which is smaller than the A sub zero. And of course, this thing will be longer by a factor F than A sub zero. Now, how long will it be? One way to think of it is to cut it down into sub-segments of length A. Okay, and for each of these sub-segments, then the energy V for this W for the sub-segment divided by 3 kT is nb squared divided by s squared. Well, that's the radius, and there are n monomers in there. And if that is an entanglement, that must be one again. Okay, so we know what is A relative to the number n, or we know n relative to A. And that means when we squeeze the thing, we create entanglements in the definition that I just used. Okay, so we increase the number of entanglements by this factor capital M, which is n sub zero divided by n, which is a sub zero squared divided by a squared. And this is equal to the square of this length f here.
Sorry, yep. I'll check and see if we were okay, and we are. Sorry, I just missed something.
What is missing?
Is this a Gaussian chain?
These are Gaussian chains, of course.
But if you compress a Gaussian chain in x and y, it doesn't affect what it does in z at all.
Well,
I thought you were suggesting that if you squeeze the Gaussian chain, it would extend in z.
Well, yes, you squeeze it here, of course it will extend its set. Well, if they are under confinement?
If they are under confinement, they stay exactly
where they are. No. They do change.
I believe he is doing two things simultaneously. I mean, he is stretching in the horizontal direction
no.
by lambda.
No, I just put this thing, this Gaussian chain, in a box.
He just squeezed it.
And I squeeze the box.
Then the Gaussian chain is the coordinates completely coupled.
I mean, that's the basic thing of a chain in a box.
The energy of the Gaussian chain is E to the R squared.
But it's. In the tube potential of Doyle divergence, the number of orbits per unit length is proportional to the size of the confining tube.
Exactly.
So that's because there's a tension.
Yeah, well.
Whether you have a tension or.
The final result is very kind of what is there mathematically. I mean, it's not.
The tension.
Gaussian chain with three ends. It has to go through the tube.
By squeezing, you increase the tension.
Well, that's the question. What do you do with the end? Do you pull more?
Well, forget about the ends. They are somewhere out there.
Do you pull it harder or not on the end?
No. What I say is that the tension here is exactly related to the diameter of this tube.
No.
Yeah?
No. If you don't pull by the ends, the average length is zero. So you have to pull.
You cannot put a chain with n sub zero monomers in a tube in a fixed box, and it will not have finite length.
The root mean squared deviation isn't zero, but the average is zero.
Well, the average is here, but I talk about the root mean square here.
It's the square root of n is not
there. Not if you force the chain to go out the ends of the tube.
Yes.
Not anymore.
Well, that's true. That has the slip links here.
One thing is this, and one thing is calling them Gaussian or non-Gaussian. It remains a Gaussian chain within a tube with the ends coming out.
You have to put tension on the end.
The words with the ends coming out need to be
in the model
written down in the formula.
Yeah.
Well, why don't you do that?
You want,
yes.
Yes.
The result is crucially dependent on the force of that. If you don't have a force, the result is zero, right? So
sure, you have a
force. But the question is how the force is coupled with.
But if it's not written down on this transparency, then how can they get
there? There is no force
without the force.
There is no force on this level.
Maybe we can just look at that formula here. Then there is the rest of the network.
But it's not in the free energy.
But it is in the free energy here. That's the free energy.
The first part implies that the ends are fixed at the distance r0, right?
Yeah.
Otherwise, you wouldn't write that.
Yeah.
Right. So then how does r0 change with a?
Well, that's what I've explained here. The r sub 0 changes, as you see here.
OK, but that is the wrong tension.
No, that's the correct tension. That's the tension that you get automatically from this argument. If the A and the tension are related in the way that we assume in the original Dye-Edwards model, that's what you get. The tension in the Dye-Edwards model is 3 kT over A. Okay?
So
if you change A, you change the tension. That's what's written here. Okay.
Keeping the ends of the chain pinned down is both necessary and sufficient, right? That is, the potential would do nothing, whereas pulling on the ends does everything you need. So it seems more accurate to say that you're pulling on the ends.
Different languages, but it's
all okay. So can we agree that each of these things here, and now the subchains have a length A, and that we increase the number of entanglements in this definition by this number M here.
But aren't you minimizing free energy under what condition?
Well, I have minimized the free energy at the start. When we prepare the network, or when we start, when we take the melt already, it is minimized.
And then you're minimizing it again?
No. I'm just saying that if I stretch it in this way, I increase the number of entanglements, that means the number of objects with energy 3 kT, by this factor M here.
And that's the part that's still missing. From the first equation, the only connection between R and A was minimal free energy, otherwise there would be
exactly. Yes?
If you keep your R the same and you just change A, you will
not. It's not changing.
No.
It's not keeping R the same.
But that, so that's my question. What is the condition of R? The minimum of fairness?
No, the condition here is to say if I change the A, then of course I will change the tension in that chain.
According to the fairness?
No. What I say is that I can find out what this thing here is, how many monomers this thing had.
Yeah.
Yeah? And then I say I calculate just how many of these things I have.
But
and this gives me this here. Well, it's a minimization of the energy
in the sub
chains here.
But you're equilibrating the cube again. You're not doing it in the condition of the previous cube you stretch.
The argument here is that originally this whole thing has an energy of 3 kT, okay? Now I do work on the system, so I increase the free energy here, and I multiply the free energy by this factor capital M. And I can visualize that as saying, I have one big blob to start with, yeah? Energy 3 kT, and now I deform it, and I get capital M blobs. Which have 3 kT.
But that's equilibrated again.
Well, of course, I have the whole thing has the same energy.
Right.
So in the background, there's a free energy exchange between all the different chains. Okay? So the capital, the energy, the total energy changes with respect to the equilibrium by this capital M. Okay? So, and then the next assumption is the expression for the stress tensor, because all of these little blobs, yeah, let's assume that they can orient differently. So we say they orient according to the affine rotation assumption. Okay, so the extra stress tensor is given as 3 kT times the number of entanglements we had initially, times M, times the orientation tensor. Where the orientation tensor is the Doyle-Edwards independent alignment tensor. Okay, so as a unit vector, you deform it, the dyadic product normalized with respect to this, the U prime without the bar here is just the length of the thing. Okay? So these are the, I would say, three assumptions that I make here.
I think other people are tending to interpret M as the ratio of the new tension in the chain over the door.
Exactly. That's how I used to think about it. But I think it's easier to visualize it as creation of new entanglements, which each of them has an energy of 3 kT. That means we have a local energetic equilibrium in the whole system. That's the advantage that I see here. Okay. Now, the rest is mathematics. You do a virtual work argument and say the work of the stress tensor that I do to the system is stored in the system due to the fact that I create new entanglements. Okay? So if you say dW, capital W dt, is equal to the work of the stress tensor, then you get an equation for m. dm dt is equal to m times the orientation tensor double dotted into the deformation rate tensor. And you can integrate that. Then it comes out m is equal to the exponent of the logarithmic average deformation, the ln of u prime averaged. That's the exact solution of this simple equation. Okay? So with this, of course, you have a free energy function, and you have the stress tensor, so that's all you need. And to get agreement with our earlier work, where we tried to do that with constant volume deformations, and I have copied some papers which are on the table here, where you can read them. Let's assume now that we look only for small deformations, small with respect to what we usually see in melts. Let's say uniaxial lambda of 100%. Then we can expand the logarithm here into u prime averaged plus a second order contribution. So the result is we have a stress tensor which is equal to the modulus at long times, the plateau, the equilibrium modulus of the rubber, times u prime, times 5 times the orientation tensor. The 5 is due to the normalization for the linear elastic part of the thing. Okay. We'll come to that in a minute down here. So now we can look at networks, and actually these are the same ones that we looked at that Michael has just brought you. They are plotted differently here. What we have done here, we have taken these networks. They all have a G infinity, which is below the plateau modulus of the relevant melts. And we have normalized them with respect to the classical measure, lambda squared minus 1 over lambda. If you do the true stress, I mean, you are using the engineering stress in most of your formulas, and divided by G infinity, by just one parameter. And then you see that these networks all collapse within the scatter on a single line. This would be the Mooney-Rivlin straight line, which would be a straight line, but we have plotted it in a double logarithmic plot, because I used the same graph to compare for the strain measure of melt. So we have a damping function here, the same we use, as I said, for melt. You can compare that with the prediction of melt. This would be the result for pure rotation, affine rotation. If we had no stretch, and we would only orient all the entanglements in the network. Now, if you see there's a difference here, this must be due to the fact that we create new entanglements or that we stress the network. So what you can do is you can directly calculate how much stress is in the network for uniaxial extension, for equibiaxial extension. And if you plot that, then you get this result here. So this is now F squared, or equals to M in this new definition here. And, pardon me? Yes. Yeah. Okay. Okay. And you see it starts out here on this straight line. This is u prime, the average logarithm, the average deformation here. And then we get these second order behavior, which at the time we attributed to some finite extensibility, but I think it's really due to the fact that we have this exponential behavior of the free energy. If you just take the straight line here and put it on these networks, that's the result you get. And you get a decent description here of this part here. And then here, you would have the second order contribution coming out. Well, I showed a few years ago that you get similar behavior for melts. So these would be the networks. And these lines here is a result for different polymer melts, linear and long chain branched. I don't want to talk about that too much. So you can look at other networks. These are data from Ehrman and Flory, radiation cross-linked networks with a limited range degree of deformation, but I think reasonably careful experiments, both in uniaxial extension and in equibiaxial extension or uniaxial compression. These lines here are just the orientation tensor times the average stretch. And you see the agreement with the data is reasonable for the different modulus that you get here. These were radiation cross-linked. And the modulus increases, of course, with the radiation. And you get that agreement with just one single parameter here. Okay, so what we have here is what I call an entanglement network, and I don't think that there is a separate contribution of the phantom, the cross-linked network. You don't see it in these data. In this case. Pardon me?
Is it much larger
Because one is much larger than another, so you can neglect it.
I think that the that there is really no difference between an entanglement in the way I defined it, 3kT, and a crosslink. As far as long as the crosslink is the distance between crosslinks is greater than the natural diameter of the entanglement. Okay? Let me just show the data. These are data which have been in literature for 50 years. Careful measurements, I think, by Mullins from 69 on natural rubbers. Yes, of course. Yeah, we should take the projection over. That makes it easier. Okay. Now the dashed curves, these lines here, are the orientation tensor times U prime averaged. Okay? You get these lines if you add the second order contribution. What you see here is that for the, these are natural rubbers cross-linked with different amount of sulfur, randomly cross-linked. If the modulus of the rubber is below the modulus of the corresponding melt, which is somewhere around here, then these lines here scale with G infinity, which is what you can read off here. Okay? So you just multiply it. You come from here to here. But then if you add more sulfur, you cross links more densely, then what you observe is, there's a, you see a difference in slope here, so you can still multiply it, but then you see what you get here is just a parallel shift of these curves. And that is now a signature of crosslinks, of the phantom network. And the simple picture we had at the time, the physical picture is that what is really happening when you crosslink a melt? So let's assume that's the melt, okay? That's the caging in, the natural A sub zero. And you can think of that of A sub zero or slip links with tension, whatever you want. Now, when you start to crosslink it, you replace some of these slip links by permanent crosslinks. That's the only thing that changes. Okay? If you look at the modulus, this would be the plateau modulus of the melt, terminal relaxation time. Then if you crosslink it, you still have relaxation, but then you have a G infinity. Yeah? You have the rubber plateau somewhere. You increase the crosslink density, the rubber plateau comes up, and at some crosslink density, you reach the plateau of the melt, of the corresponding melt. This is the case when you have effectively replaced all slip links here by crosslinks. But up to this stage, you cannot distinguish this strain, stress-strain behavior from this one here.
Don't you need two crosslinks per chain to get that back to the rubber plateau? Like
what is it?
If you have very, very long chain.
Yes.
Is enough to have just a couple of crosslinks for the thing to be permanently entangled so you don't get
yes.
Back to the plateau?
Well, you get... No. No, if you go from the melt to the gel, yeah, the terminal relaxation time will show a power law behavior. Then you have a continuous path from one side of your sample to the other side of your sample.
Right.
That's the gelation point. Okay. That means you have one molecule. More or less. Okay, depends on your definition. My definition is that you have your power law, then if you add one more, then at long times you will see a plateau. That's G infinity over rubber. No?
Right, but if your rubber has more than a couple of crosslinks per chain,
yeah.
you already reached the rubber plateau.
Well, certainly. I mean, you go up here, and that means you have more. What is chain? The original chain.
Original chain.
The original chain. If it depends on the number of crosslinks, compared to the number of entanglements. That's the critical number. Yeah. Okay. So it's no question that there are rubbers with plateau modulus this modulus, G infinity below the plateau modulus of the melt, and there are others, this plateau modulus above the plateau modulus. Just look at the data. Okay?
Do not confuse chains with subchains.
Well, that's, I don't know what chains, but we can discuss it later on. It's no question. If you look at the numbers.
Let's discuss this point in a moment.
Okay.
You say that if you put two cross links per chain, the permanent plateau modulus, the permanent modulus of the rubber, which comes from the cross link, is the same as the plateau modulus of the net?
I'm saying the crossover from modulus of the rubber.
So the modulus of the melt is this one here.
If you have very, very long chains, you have hundreds of cross links, pentagons per chain.
Yeah.
It's enough to have of order one, like two or three cross links per chain, primary chain, to reach the modulus of a net of the melt and you go above.
No.
But which?
No.
No. Because they'll be dangling in, which means
but
once you throw away that mass, you have
Because you have all trapped
them. You have trapped entanglements.
Exactly. So you have two or three, and I didn't say two, I said one or two. You have hundreds of entanglements, you have only two or three crosses per chain.
Michael, if you have two per chain and they're randomly distributed, they have like a finite fraction of your mass, half or something, is entangling in. Okay. If you take that part away, then it's as if you had a solution at finite volume fraction, and so your modulus would be down by some factor like that.
Right, then you go from 2 to 4 and 6.
Exactly. Well, I'm not arguing, very lucky. I'm just saying there's a factor of order unity there, which is, you know.
But that's factor per chain, not independent number of entanglements. So I'm saying you have a very large number of entanglements. So the crossover can nothing do with number of cross links equals number of entanglements. The crossover
Number
of cross links per chain.
The crossover is here.
25% of the eventual plateau modulus or something like that.
Right. And then if you go to, if you have 4, you're going to get another factor of. If you have 55 or 100 entanglements, you will reach plateau modulus at just the same few cross links per chain.
Well, the plateau modulus of this material here is somewhere in this range. Okay, you can look it up by ferry.
Sure.
Okay, so there are rubbers.
Of course.
So what is the argument?
That means that they have only a few entanglements per. I'm saying that this is. You don't know how many entanglements there are anyway, so it's hard to compare.
No, I say you cannot distinguish. That's my argument. There's no distinction between the crosslink and the entanglement.
If you have simulations, it is distinguished.
Simulation is different, but if you look at the data here, you cannot distinguish whether. The cross-linked entanglements behave exactly the same as the entanglements proper.
They'll
discuss it. Later. The point I want to make here is that if you have effectively saturated your entanglement network with crosslinks, you reach the plateau modulus of the melt, you go above that, and then you see the effective effect of the additional crosslinks, because they are now shorter than your mesh size or whatever you call that. And I think this is good news. Yeah, it shows that on small scales here, you really have a phantom network, because it does not see the topological constraint composed by the neighbors. So you have a true phantom contribution in this situation. And that's what the data show. I mean, if you look at these data here, and at, I can show you some more, you always find this behavior. Down there, it scales with one number. And from a certain G infinity, all you have to do is to add a phantom contribution. The phantom contribution is just a vertical shift here.
So that means that the C2 term decreases above the.
Exactly. And that's what you see experimentally. I mean, that's what the people in the field U for decades. Yeah. So in the case of G infinity above the modulus of the melt, you have to add a crosslink modulus times the classical strain measure, which is C minus one or something. The finger tensor, yeah, three times. This thing is a finger tensor. Okay? And as I say, I could show you more, but let's save time. Just your point, I mean, if you look at the data, this is how what we got out of the literature, at least at the time. If you recalculate that in terms of C2 and C1, the ratio of C2 to C1 is roughly 1. If you are below the entanglement, the melt plateau modulus, and then it falls off inverse proportional because you increase the Gosling density. Okay?
Isn't that the thing I had put in an equation 89?
Yeah, probably. Probably, except that there is a region where the two are the same. There are a few scattering data, neutron scattering data from a French group that I calculated. They gave the data for, what is it, PTNS and cross-linked. So rather carefully prepared networks, deuterated chains. And they gave the radius of gyration in the parallel and in the perpendicular direction. Yeah, of for uniaxial extension. And the green line is what you get for the affine deformation assumption. So if you assume that these chains would be deformed affinely, this is what the radius of gyration in parallel and perpendicular direction would do. And then they compared the results with the affine rotation assumption, assuming you have unit vectors which deform, rotate affinely, and then you get the blue curve. This dotted curve is actually what they had, but they made a mistake in the averages, which I corrected in that paper. So this is what you would get for the pure affine rotation part. And now if you put in just the first part of that expansion, the U prime part, then you get the red line here. So this red line corresponds to this stress-strain behavior. And the blue line corresponded to the one you saw earlier, and that would be the affine deformation line. So you can get at least an idea of the radius of gyration from this very simple model. Okay, and one final slide. I realize it's late. If you extend these ideas to swollen networks of your Gaussian chains. So this is for the, what is it? Two different, 1953, 1971. You see, there's not too much progress in that area over these years. You can describe, as I say, all of these lines by just one single parameter. This number here will give you all the lines, because the modulus here of the swollen networks is just this geometric volume fraction to the 2/3 times the plateau modulus. And that's all you need, which comes easily out of these arguments.
And the G infinity has both MC and ME inside.
Exactly. The G infinity has the total information of the network. So whether you have randomly cross-linked or loops or local defects, you're all counted by G infinity. Yeah, and the network, of course, averages over everything, but the average is already done here when you measure this number here. So of course, if you want to make a theory, then you have to study the kinetics of cross-linking, and that would define exactly what this number is here for a given system. But once you have this number, everything else comes out automatically from this simple picture. Okay, that's it.
Does this account for complexity?
It accounts for compression too, but there are no data here for biaxial expression. So the summary is I tried to put it simple. There's no distinction, at least I cannot find any distinction in the data for rubbers with a modulus below the plateau modulus of the melt between the phantom contribution, the crosslink contribution, and the entanglement network. Behaves exactly in the same way. There is a phantom network if you are above the plateau modulus, because then the distance between crosslinks on average is shorter than whatever tube diameter or entanglement diameter you have in mind. So these do not feel the topological contributions. And for this case, when you are below the plateau modulus of the melt, you can describe the whole stress-strain relations of rubbers, even in the swollen state, with just one material parameter. G infinity is all you need.
Can I ask a very naive question?
Yes, of course.
Our last speaker says that we need to expand the tube diameter.
Yes.
Say we need to shrink the tube diameter. Oh, sorry.
No, no.
Say
no, no. Direction. But it shrinks in the other two directions.
I maintain that in spite of the apparent enormous difference between the two presentations, in reality they get very close.
There's a subtle point about the phantom contribution, which I'm not clear.
That's not as important as what you're asking about tube diameter.
Yeah.
Can you explain if your tube diameter gets narrow, so you have more entanglement?
Yes.
How can you get strain softening?
You get the strain softening. The basic origin of the chain of the strain softening is orientation. If you have just orientation, no extension, assume that there is no stretch. You just have entanglements, and these entanglements orient. Okay? Then this is the result. This is Stoyevich. This is what you assume for a melt.
And the increase in the way I'm choosing to interpret, the increase in the tension simply isn't enough to compensate for that. That is in the class.
No, the increase in tension will compensate, will bring it up to this level here in the first term, and if you add the second term, you can get it.
Not up to classical rubber elasticity.
Pardon me?
You'll bring it up to close to the experimental data, but not back up to classical rubber elasticity. So
no, it does not bring it up to classical rubber elasticity.
Partial retraction. You don't stretch it finally, but if you retract a little bit.
It is in physical terms, you say you do not stretch it affinely, definitely not. But what you multiply this thing here is by assuming that all strands, irrespective of their orientation, will be expanded by the average deformation. So if you take the deformation, you average over all orientations. Yeah, that is the measure. That's the correct measure, because it measures the energy. That's what I tried to explain in the first instance.
Let me try a similar idea, in slightly different language. Okay. I think this is a sufficiently simple idea, so I'm curious whether it's actually being done. The Doy-Edwards theory has alignment and complete retraction, and you're using the Doy-Edwards tensor.
Yes.
Suppose I had a theory in which I said I have the Doy-Edwards alignment, and then I pick the tension to be the same in all segments based on the idea that monomer could shuffle up and down the tube.
Yeah.
But I pick that tension to be whatever is required to get the affine change in the length of the chain.
Mm.
That is...
No.
Well, this is what Peano did 1981, okay? And what Gressley did 79.
He recovers enough to obey the rule of the tube in a contracted.
Yeah.
But how can you recover the network?
Yeah. I'm not saying that the picture.
That's the picture.
I'm saying that the final answer is very close.
Are you saying to do a network contraction to get the final?
If I had a uniform tube and adjusted the tension so that I got the right tube length, the right primitive path length, the affine link deformed primitive path length,
well,
then you would recover the classical rubber law.
Well, slightly less.
I calculated in 79.
81, I think.
What Martin did here. What fluidity in there?
No. May I just make this point clear? And I think that's the difference to what comes out from your assumption. If you take the tube, and now you assume in the usual way the tube is deformed affinely. Okay? And no, you assume that also the diameter changes affinely. That means, of course, if you stretch the network, let's say in this direction here, then this part of the tube will become smaller, okay? And this part here, which is perpendicular to it, will become larger. So finally, you have a system which looks like this, okay? And then you can shuffle around, of course, your monomers, as Mike has just done, okay? Now this will give you, if you do that the way Gressley and Pino did that, that will give you a stress tension. Yes. Well, it will give you actually very little in softening because if you assume a fine deformation of the tube, this gives you this tensor here, the Doy-Edwards proper tensor. Okay? Where you normalize just one of these unit vectors. Okay? And then instead of dividing by 1 over u prime, you multiply by this. This takes into account the reshuffling here.
It takes into account.
Okay? And the result of this thing will give you a very soft strain softening here, and I think some strain hardening on this side. So you get something of this type. I made the calculations sometime. Now, what I claim is that you do not go from here to here, but eventually...
Manfred, yes. I want to correct. That result is yes. Obtained if you leave the tube diameter unchanged.
Or to put it another way, you can get this result without a tube at all, with slip links.
Yeah.
If you deform the slip links and have a constant tension between slip links, you'll get this.
Yeah. Which means tube diameter unchanged. If you do the thing you're picturing there, what you get...
Well, we can.
If I remember correctly...
I can't find out.
Is that you get only the first part without the front part.
You mean this thing here?
The signal.
Yeah,
no, this one here.
Which is not very far from what you do, because you have the new prime inside and the new radio.
Yeah, it gives you a slope here.
It was done by the team.
Okay.
In your model, you allow
things to come. Now, in my model, I say tube diameter is energy. Energy is isotropic. Even in a deformed system, yeah, we have thermal exchange. Yeah, so each of these segments will have 3 kT, and that means that this thing here will have the same diameter as this one here. So the diameter will be the same irrespective of the orientation. That's the basic assumption here.
And then the length is determined by
what? And the length is
determined by diameter.
By the diameter, yeah, which you can calculate self-consistent from. Well, it is deformed, of course. It is. The first term is the average deformation. Okay, but the better way I think is to have it in this way. Well, this is the first term of the expansion. Okay, so this is you could say it's the average energy of whatever segments you have in there, or the number of segments that you create, the relative number.
If you don't do what you did, if you don't bring a constant with two. And I relate the tension to the extension in the tube.
Yes.
Do I get an end-to-end, do I get a primitive path length that actually doesn't deform it finally, even for a large section of tube? I wonder whether it's geometrically inconsistent. A long tube should deform it finally.
Well, that's one of the problems. That's one of the problems that this simple model has. I cannot tell you on what length scale we recover the affine limit.
I guess only the end-to-end vectors.
The only building blocks of this model are entanglement, segments of a chain. And I just look at the segments. And I say all segments are the same and they behave the same and they just orient
independent of their
And that seems to agree reasonably well with what I see experimentally and what I see even not only for melts but also for not only for rubbers but also for melts.
But it does sound very different from what he's saying because the essential idea is that the fluctuations are different in different macroscopic directions.
Well, I mean, probably the tube slip tube model could be remodeled in this case by assuming that the amount of change is independent of the orientation.
Well, if you assume that, there will be no slippage, but there is no reason for it to slip. The orientation is the same. The tube is the same. The only reason for slippage is because the tube is different.
Well,
the entropy is different different direction, otherwise it would not want to move it in a different direction.
Well, then you have to go back one step and say you just allow for the thing to change diameter or the form of your confining potential.
Is it fair to say on the basis of what you did that that a straightforward extension of the Doyen standard function simply doesn't work for a rubber? That's the conclusion I'm attempting to
draw. Well, the Doy-Edwards thing is this one.
Well, that's without any stretch.
Yeah, that's the.
Well, no, that's with stretch. That's without any stretch.
But that's not consistent because the ends are tucked in.
No, what it is consistent, it is consistent in this region here. So for small deformations, there's no stretch. There's only orientation. And this is captured by the orientation tensor of Doy-Edwards.
Is it fair to say that what
that
you
stretch is a second order?
Yeah, stretch is a second order thing.
The fluidity of the a part of the fluidity of the Doy-Edwards melt representation of the stress that you have written in red there.
Yep.
With a solidity of a rubber elasticity.
No, I didn't understand that, Chris. That's good.
The second term.
This one here.
Is this one?
Oh,
yes. This is in your model.
That's in the model. I mean, the
you
the.
You added that with something which is only elastic. So it's a mixture of this and elastic. It's a fluid solid.
No, all I do is I multiply this thing. Plus the cube graph anyway.
Probably
yes.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Thanks very much.